Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody. And welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Cole Roscombe, who's Associate Professor of Architectural History at the University of Hong Kong. And he'll be talking about his new book, Improvised City, Architecture and Governance in Shanghai, 1843 to 1937, which was published in 2019 by University of Washington Press. Few places tell the story of modern China in the way that the city of Shanghai does, for not only is it today the PRC mainland's main financial hub and centre of commerce, but it's also among the most famous former sites in which the foreign semi-colonisation of China unfolded, a history which is, of course, so important to the tale the present-day Communist Party tells about itself and the nation. If this means that Shanghai has a somewhat layered and contested identity, then Cole Roscombe's book Improvised City shows us that such contestation has always been a feature of the city's existence. Roscombe's uniquely revealing account of the period from the 1840s birth of colonial Shanghai up to the 1930s Japanese invasion narrates the metropolis's multiple pasts through a staunchly material lens, focusing on town planning, public spaces, monumental buildings, and more everyday architecture too. Much more than an account told from an elevated or detached vantage point, Roscombe's book takes us down to ground level, evoking the movement, the open boulevards and narrow lanes of Shanghai as it took shape under the often competing influences of Chinese, British, French, American, and other governors and architects. Such an intimate portrait shows us convincingly that this place, envisioned by the colonists as an arena for free marketeering and rational governance, often ended up being anything but, giving modern Shanghai a tangled legacy, which arguably plays a role right up to the present. But the author himself is here to tease out some of these tangles, so I'll say, Cole Roscombe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ed. I really appreciate your invitation, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's fantastic to have you to talk about what I think is a particularly kind of interesting subject, given what's going on in many Chinese cities today. Mm-hmm. But before we jump into the book itself, perhaps I'll ask you initially about your background and how you came in to be interested in architecture in Shanghai and governance and these questions which the book deals with.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I began to study architecture and Mandarin Chinese as an undergraduate in a small liberal arts college, Connecticut College in the United States. And it was through my experience in both studying art and architectural history as well as Chinese that I came to complete a senior honors thesis on 20th century Chinese architecture. And so I suppose that's really where the seeds of the project lie. I worked for several years and traveled to China and then ultimately returned to graduate school to complete a PhD in the Department of History of Art and Architecture at Harvard University. And it was there that I completed the dissertation upon which this book is based.
I see. So, you began in a kind of architecture-specific field, or at least with Chinese too. But what was it that, made you, I guess, move away from the possibility of, say, practicing architecture into studying it as a historical, practice?
Well, I suppose I need to be honest and admit first my own limitations as a designer were a factor. I did enjoy studying architecture, and also had several internships with a few firms when I was in college, and I realized that I'm very much more enjoyed reading and writing about architecture than actually designing it myself. The richness of China's own architectural history was also incredibly attractive to me. And I had spent a semester abroad in China in 1997, which is really the first time that I also visited Shanghai. And it was at that point that I really began to, I suppose, dig into the history of China's urban fabric and trying to understand exactly the role played by architecture and buildings in the country's past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the actual subject of the book and the focus on Shanghai, this was something that came through your doctoral work. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I wanted to work on Shanghai in part because for all of the ample existing literature on Shanghai, I found that much of it focused on a few key sites or a few key building types within the city. Most of Shanghai's architectural history is told through the history of the Bund or through housing such as the iconic Lilong fabric within the city. But there seemed to be very little engagement or analysis of what could be termed, I guess, civil architecture or public architecture, the kind of architecture of governance. And that may be in part because it's a complex story to tell. There were so many different vested interests in the city, particularly over its nearly 100-year history as a treaty port. But it also speaks to, I think, the generalization that Shanghai was first and foremost a commercial entrepot, and in essence that there were no politics happening on the ground, so to speak. But of course there were, and of course it was a very politically charged place. And as the argument of my book goes, architecture was very much contributing to and participating within that those political tensions and the efforts to govern the city.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that kind of is the message that comes out so strongly from the book, which, yeah, does, I think, manage to take on what you rightly point out is a pretty daunting task, bringing together the multiple interests and the influences, as I mentioned in the intro there, the French and the British and the American, as well as, you know, the Qing and subsequently Republican governments who were, playing a role in managing the Chinese city and also interacting with these foreign powers. And I think all of that comes through brilliantly well in a way that brings out completely, to me at least, astonishing aspects of what the city looked like and how it works. That I should add that the book is supplemented by a really rich array of architectural designs and drawings and plans, as well as historical photographs and some contemporary ones too. And so I think the kind of task that you've taken on there to enhance our understanding of things beyond the Bund and the like is wonderfully executed. But we'll jump in then perhaps to the actual introduction in which you kind of outline more of the arguments and the kind of projects that you're taking on here. I guess as much out of curiosity as anything else, I wonder if you could just say something about what the city was before some of these kind of foreign colonial powers arrived. What was the nature of Shanghai as a Qing dynasty metropolis or walled city, or what was going on there?
Yeah, Shanghai was a very active port for trade between different parts of China and East and Southeast Asia long prior to the advent of the treaty port system, in fact. And actually one of the reasons that it was so attractive to British merchants looking to expand their trade, particularly in opium up along the Chinese coast, was that existing trade activity and the potential for exchange with Europe. And one key text that covers this history very well is a book by Linda Cook Johnson called From Market Town to Treaty Port. Mm-hmm. And in that book, she actually really covers the entire development of Shanghai from a small regional market town into the quote-unquote international treaty port that it became. But there were several quintessential features of the city's built environment that were there long prior to European arrival that subsequently then played a very important role in the development of the European sections of the city. Foremost among them maybe being the city wall, which was initially built in the mid-16th century, 1554, to guard against occupation and invasion, pillaging by Japanese pirates. And that is, Shanghai being a port was, of course, vulnerable to that kind of activity. And so those vulnerabilities would become, I think, inscribed within the city's fabric, again, long prior to British arrival and the signing of the Nanjing Treaty that established the city as a treaty port.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of then chart the, incorporation of the city and this area into the treaty port regime, and say, I think, in the introduction, some pretty interesting things about what the treaty port system was as a sort of administrative or a governance-based artifact in a Chinese context. Could you say a bit more about this how the treaty port system sat within existing kind of legal frameworks and governance practices in Qing China?
Yeah, so this was one of the challenges that I faced when I was when I tackled the project as a dissertation and then as a book, because there was so much written about Shanghai, I had to really look at identifying topics and periods of the city's history that had not been covered, and I found that one of the periods was this initial arrival of British and American and then French merchants and other merchants from around the world into the city, and how that arrival kind of materialized in space, in architectural form. And one of the ways that I tried to understand that was within the context of the legal system that was established, the extraterritorial rights that were extended to British and then subsequently other merchants of other countries and territories around the world within China. And essentially what extraterritoriality cemented for these non-Chinese merchants was an impunity or a freedom from existing Qing law. And so that state of exceptionality was very interesting to me, particularly when I partnered it or thought of it in relationship to architecture, that Shanghai was never a colony per se. China was never colonized in the traditional sense of the word. It was, one could argue that the Qing dynasty was a colonial power or an imperial power, but that's of course very sensitive to the party today. But Shanghai and China historically were kind of understood as quote unquote semi-colonial entities. That is, there were some aspects of the treaty port's governance that took on the kind of operative appearance of a colony, but in other ways it was not typically traditionally colonial. And that was something I also wanted to push up against. I didn't really find this term, the semi-colony or the semi-colonial, to really be an effective term of analysis in a way. I didn't know what it opened up, even though it's, of course, been a tried and true term, again, used to describe the history of Shanghai for most of the 20th century. Used by figures like Sun Yat-sen and Mao Zedong even to describe this particular historical period in China. The term that I kept circling around again was this idea of extraterritoriality. And it's understood primarily, again, as a legal term, but also very much comes out of the Qing Empire's efforts to integrate what was happening as a result of the First Opium War within the existing Qing tribute system, which were these series of social and diplomatic practices that very much dictated Imperial China's relationship with other parts of the non-Chinese world. So I suppose a long-winded response to your question was that extraterritoriality in some ways comes out of existing Qing precedent and law in some ways, and it became a kind of useful concept for me to think about how the architectural history of that period might also be understood. That there was an effort on the part of the Qing government to maintain a certain degree of segregation or separation of Chinese and non-Chinese residents. But then, of course, over time, that separation took on new and increasingly destabilizing dimensions.
Right, right. Now, I think that is a sort of really compelling new way of looking at, or at least to me, new, possibly it's been done elsewhere, but it was very interesting to see extraterritoriality and the treaty port idea seen from the perspective of existing Qing structures and, you know, not just something that suddenly appeared out of nowhere and didn't, you know, have any context or any kind of deeper roots.
The source, sorry to interrupt you, but just to be true to my sources here, there's a fantastic book by Par Christopher Castle called Grounds of Judgment, Extraterritoriality and Imperial Power in 19th Century China and Japan. And his book is very much offers a legal history of extraterritoriality and the establishment of the International Mixed Court in Shanghai. And that that was a very useful text for me to think about how something like extraterritoriality might have taken on spatial and architectural dimensions.
Right. And I guess it is that kind of architectural novelty and newness and the differences, the very notable contrasts between architectural styles and practices in the city that subsequently developed after this European arrival. In the mid 19th century, that makes the contrast between what was there before and what subsequently followed seem so stark, and in some ways, I guess, seem so contextless, if you like. But in terms of what role architecture was actually playing here, and how you conceived of the relationship between the practices of design and projection and architecture, and the actual governance and the power regimes that were going on in practice. I mean, how did you conceive of that? Relationship? Was it just that, you know, big buildings represent big, powerful colonists? I mean, clearly that's a very, very simplistic way of putting it. But yeah, what was your kind of take on how these things interacted?
Yeah, monumentality was certainly part of it. I mean, there was a physical dimension to the scale and the size of European buildings being constructed. But yes, yeah, I tried to kind of dig beyond that and offer more than just a kind of physical or aesthetic study of the city. And one of the ways I began to think about architecture was very much as this anticipatory discipline, that there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty about Shanghai and really the whole treaty port system as a kind of viable enterprise. I mean, it in some ways was, an unprecedented new governing structure imposed upon China. Beginning in 1843. And so the fact that so little was actually known about the potential development of the treaty port system, the future that was completely unknown, architecture historically has kind of relished and enthusiastically engaged with those unknowns, right? We look to designers to show us the future in a way. And so some of the first architectural projects within Shanghai proposed by engineers, many of whom were associated with, Freemasonry and were arriving in Shanghai from places like Guangzhou and Hong Kong, that they were very much the kind of visionaries who stabilized this new enterprise in physical ways, but also in procedural ways through the practice of architecture. And over time, in the book, I trace the emergence of building codes, which are, of course, very exploitative and dismissive of the Chinese population within the city. And that those offer a kind of mode of governance in a way. They offer a mode of control that needs to be taken seriously. But at the same time, even as architecture is attempting or making an effort to kind of stabilize this enterprise, there's still this element of improvisation, which comes out of the book title. And that notion of an improvised city comes from a direct quote that I found in my research. I think I embedded it in chapter 2. At one point, I asked the editor of the book whether the book should begin with that quote, but she thought that it was a useful Easter egg to kind of hide to hide within the book and hope that people might get to it. But it's in reference to this moment in 1863 where a group of British landowners or land renters are writing Frederick Bruce, who was the British envoy to Beijing at that point in time. And 1863 is a very eventful moment in the city's history. The Taiping Rebellion is raging, and the tens of thousands of Chinese refugees essentially flood into the British settlement, which previous to that point in time had been segregated. And with this kind of this sudden integration of the British settlement, several of the merchants begin to, being enterprising capitalists that they are, build a series of hastily constructed tenement houses to support this new population. And it very much transforms what the British settlement was and what it was expected to be. Suddenly it is this integrated district, if you were, within Shanghai. And so this group of land renters write to Bruce to describe Shanghai as an improvised city, as a city very much where normal activities associated with municipal development and physical construction take place very quickly and become very expensive. And so I was really interested in that idea too, that what we understand of as kind of decades, if not centuries long processes of the building of a community, so to speak, or the construction of a kind of civic sphere, was being sped up and improvised, if you will, in Shanghai. And so that became a very evocative image for me and helped me kind of formulate some of my ideas and arguments.
Right. And to what extent did that kind of improvisatory nature of how the city came together stem from the fact that there were so many different simultaneously occurring projects going on there, you know, backed by different powers? I mean, I guess I also hadn't fully appreciated the sort of geographical distribution of where the Chinese city was in relation to the French concession, a very well-known area of Shanghai next to it, and then the international settlement, which is kind of British and American area. And then, of course, there were Russian and latterly, I guess, Japanese influences and many others too. I mean, was the improvisation, as you see it, partly a product of this kind of multiplicity of different regimes of governance and indeed of town planning?
I see it that way. I would understand this idea of improvisation as being a much broader kind of category to describe the loose, anxious cosmopolitanism of the place that very much spoke not only to the diversity of the city's international population, but also its Chinese population. People from all over the Qing Empire coming to the city, working within the city, traveling through the city. Exchanging goods, buying and selling products, that kind of improvised quality was very much specific to the diversity and the complexity of the place. But the way I suppose that the original quote is understanding this idea of improvisation is in response to the actual procedure by which municipalities take shape. That the actual governance, the administration, the construction of public buildings, that all of that becomes much hastier and much more spontaneous in a physical, cultural, economic setting like Shanghai. That's maybe the third dimension to this, is the economic nature of the place was such that this was very much a place that was intended for free market enterprise. The desire on the part of British merchants to settle in Shanghai in the first place was in part in response to what they felt were the undue confines of their rights as merchants to trade with Chinese merchants in Guangzhou and in Canton. And they felt very much restricted, legally restricted, but also physically restricted by the factory system in Guangzhou. And Shanghai was, and the other treaty ports were expected to kind of remedy that situation. So that's the other dimension here.
Sure. And we can perhaps jump in a bit later into whether or not this actually realized itself as a project and you know, the role of, I guess, yeah, free trade as a sort of ideological cudgel through which to beat, you know, potentially resistant colonial subjects on the part of the British. But we'll go into, I think, the kind of body of the book at this point and chapter one, where we really get quite immediately down to the level of detail, which really is woven throughout the entire volume, looking at the actual architectural forms of some of these sort of newly extraterritorial buildings as you're conceiving of them. And I was particularly interested, you mentioned just now Canton, Guangzhou, and these kind of more restricted quarters in which trade was occurring with China before the foundation of Shanghai's international settlement and so on. And there were architectural forms that were sort of transferred, and there were precedents for some of how the buildings were designed in the newly built urban space of Shanghai, because there was already some precedent set in Guangzhou and also other colonial ports of European empire. So could you say something about some of these architectural features of buildings that started to spring up once the kind of treaty port system had been established?
Yeah, absolutely. You're referencing, I think, building types such as the godown or the warehouse and verandas and mercantile compounds, which all began to take shape in Shanghai very, very shortly after the establishment of the treaty port. The first British merchants began to arrive in November 1843, traveling from Guangzhou and Hong Kong, Macau, and bringing with them building expertise that had been honed in southeastern China, as well as other parts of Southeast Asia and even British-controlled India. These are very much spaces that have been crafted and refined over time in the name of a kind of, you know, imperial capitalistic project. Warehouses were expected... were early in standardized building types that were expected to protect goods and to ensure goods against fire and against water damage. They became early important architectural objects that reassured investors back home in London, for example, of the security and the safety of an investment. Verandas were porch-like structures that extended beyond the main body of a merchant's house. These were also, I should say, these were homes that were also offices. So they were very much sort of combinations of personal and professional spaces that took shape as kind of large two-story compounds, if you will, with multiple structures on them. And verandas were useful for several reasons. The first was they offered a kind of liminal space from the outside into the inside, a kind of semi-public zone where British merchants could interact with, Chinese servants or with Chinese businessmen. They also served an obvious climactic purpose. They kept the house cool in the summer and protected the foundation from rain and from rot. Shanghai can be, it's humid throughout the year, but can be quite wet and damp in the winter. And so something like a veranda was offered a useful protective structure against those kinds of environmental conditions. And then, of course, yeah, so both of those then fall within the broader umbrella of the compound itself, which, again, as I mentioned, consisted of office space and personal spaces like bedrooms, kitchens, dining rooms, studies, kitchens, which were often located behind the main house and usually connected with something like a roofed walkway where Chinese servants could go out and cook and then bring the food into the compound itself. So these were quite complex spaces that performed on a variety of different levels.
And they sort of still seem, despite the fact that, I guess, as you say, what merchants were notionally looking for up further north than Guangzhou was a freedom to operate and a kind of greater level of openness than was available to them in Guangzhou, that there was still a kind of slightly almost defensive atmosphere about them, would you say? I mean, the kind of the idea of a compound, the idea of a sort of closed unit of space, still seems like it had a kind of almost self-isolating quality about it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, there is a fortress-like appearance to some of these projects that's notable. And they certainly also represent, I think, a response to where merchants were living in Guangzhou, which was what were called the 13 factories, which were a series of kind of essentially row-like compounds that extended backwards. So they were very narrow, but quite deep. And those spaces were shared and subdivided by various merchants over time and became increasingly congested by the mid-19th century. There was a very famous fire that broke out within them, and that caused a tremendous amount of damage. And so you see in correspondence during the 1820s and then 1830s, you see British merchants in particular increasingly complaining about the confines of these spaces and their desire to essentially have more room, to have more space. And so in that sense, Shanghai and also Hong Kong, of course, accommodated those requests.
Mm, mm. But it's interesting, yeah, that even that, notwithstanding the kind of atmosphere of what they then built in some of these places, still had a sort of, yeah, as you say, slightly fortified quality to them. But as you move through into the next couple of chapters of the book, I think you highlight in some ways why it might have been seen as necessary, because certainly resistance from local populations who were, you know, often just as mad at the Qing dynasty as they were at the foreign colonists and occupants, in terms of being, you know, mounting rebellions and so on, was a feature of life in Shanghai. And so you kind of draw out what the fate of the city was under the attacks, for example, of a group called the Small Sword Society, was it? A kind of localized uprising, and also the much larger, arguably the biggest civil conflict, most deadly civil conflict ever to have occurred in the world, right? People say the Taiping Rebellion. So how did these things affect how the project of building Shanghai sort of unfolded? And in particular, I'd be interested to see or to hear how the population of the city kind of shifted under the influence of actual kind of threat from armed groups.
Yeah. So both the Small Sword Society and then the repercussions or the reverberations of the Taiping Rebellion had consequential effects on Shanghai's development, particularly in relationship to the integration of the foreign settlements. Initially, when British merchants first arrived in Shanghai, they actually had hoped, some of them at least, had hoped to live within the Chinese city walls, in part because that afforded a degree of access to Chinese merchants, which they could use to establish networks and develop their own businesses. But the city was so congested working within the city was so difficult that they quickly moved out to the north of the Chinese city walls and established the British settlement. And there they had more room, of course, and more space. And that was also in the interests of the Qing government, who wanted to isolate and segregate the Chinese population from the non-Chinese population. And so a policy of segregation was established in which no Chinese residents, except for those who are working for these merchants, could live within the British settlement. The French concession too was technically segregated, although because it was essentially sandwiched in between the British settlement and the Chinese city, it was within much more intimate proximity of the Chinese city itself. And so there was some overflow taking place between the two sites, even prior to the Small Swords Rebellion and the Small Swords Uprising and the Taiping Rebellion. Mm. But with both of those events, which involved the kind of occupation and extreme disruption of daily life within the Chinese city, essentially an influx of Chinese residents into both all three of the foreign settlements prompted this this kind of spontaneous integration of the places, and that came with a variety of different negotiations and debate over whether that segregation should be, whether that integration should be embraced and how it should be regulated. And in the end, architecture actually emerged as a kind of mediating agent of a sort, in which there was integration within the foreign settlements, but through the establishment of things like building codes, a certain degree of distance and distinction could be established between the foreign population and the Chinese population, as it were.
Right, right. And in terms of the actual constructive actions that occurred in the wake of some of these rebellions, I mean, you highlight kind of commemorative actions, for example, the erection of memorials to British and French people who died in conflict with some of these armed groups. And how did the shape of the city change in response to that, not just in terms of integrating and regulating the population, but also kind of, I guess, symbolizing a new kind of governance and assertion of power over that area by the people who were kind of living there?
Yeah, these new spatial type essentially emerges, this public memorial, out of both of these two violent episodes. With the loss of life, there's desire on the part of foreign residents to commemorate and memorialize what's happened. And so Western practices of public monument design and construction begin to take place. Of course, there's an existing Chinese tradition of public commemoration of tragedies through the erection, for example, of pilo, these ceremonial archways within parts of the city, or certainly within specific temples, Confucian temples or Buddhist temples. There's a certain worship and acknowledgement of memorial events. But with the construction of these specific monuments, you begin to see the emergence of this kind of broader, bigger public consciousness that transcends in some ways the physical parameters or boundaries of each of the quarters of Shanghai, which at this point in time consists of the international settlement, which has been formed by the British and American settlements joining together, the French concession, and then the walled Chinese city. So I was able to find in some of my archival digging these, not only the design and construction of some of these memorials, but also a degree of public pageantry and events that took place in which there were participants from various segments of the Shanghai public in these public demonstrations and ceremonies. So that was very interesting to me, and precedes actually existing scholarship that argues for the emergence of a kind of transnational community in Shanghai in the late 19th century, the 1890s or so. These seem to be events that preceded those events by at least two decades.
Right. No, I think it's really fascinating to see that spatial sort of reflection of what you also chart as a greater level of integration and the kind of or some kind of integration and the emergence of a new public, both as a human kind of corporate entity, but also as something that is reflected in public space and the like. But as you say, with this kind of increasing contact between populations, in some ways, I guess the burden for segregating things had to shift towards the governance end of the spectrum rather than necessarily the demarcation side of things. So if people were no longer going to be living in totally separate zones or the Qing walled city, for example, then, as you say, regulations and things were introduced to kind of keep people separated and often, on very sort of stark racial lines. Sort of as we move into the latter half of the book, how do you kind of conceive of this new sort of set of regulations and regimes and things like the professionalization of architecture influencing the makeup of the city. I mean, who were the architects of the city of Shanghai at this point in the latter part of the 19th century? And how did that kind of change as these new regulations were introduced?
Yeah, so the first professionally trained architects in Shanghai are kind of often Masonic affiliated, again, British engineers who are often sent to Asia by foreign mercantile companies, and they are responsible for the building of a lot of the first mercantile spaces and infrastructural projects that we see in a place like Shanghai. Things like the construction of like waterways and bridges and things. And so they have a degree of expertise that is new within the city. Of course, there's an entire existing construction industry that's Chinese produced, and there are incredibly talented craftsmen and designers on the part of the Chinese building industry. But over time, as these two factions begin to interact with each other, they begin to compete with each other, and so this interesting discourse on expertise begins to emerge in the 1870s into the 1880s, a number of what could be termed, I guess, architectural entrepreneurs begin to arrive in the city from other parts of Asia and other parts of the world. And there's eventually an effort to kind of professionalize the architecture industry within the foreign community. And this is in part, I think, in response to not only to the cosmopolitanism of the foreign community, but also to this tension with the Chinese building industry as well. So that's that element of expertise is, I think, one way in which we see the power dynamics of Shanghai begin to change and begin to filter out into other aspects of architecture. There's also the emergence of social clubs, which are segregated, of course, to specific segments of the population. And there are buildings that are constructed to support these specific organizations. And so that's another way that architecture is participating to kind of the informal segregation taking place within the city.
And you talk about the kind of attitudes towards both this figure of the Chinese builder, again, in the sort of line of with this racializing, segregationary sort of dynamics that were going on. I mean, I think the thing that probably almost all listeners and possibly almost all people may have heard of with any interest in China is this kind of iconic no Chinese or dogs, horrendous signs. And, maybe this was particularly flagrant example, but it was somewhere that, some dynamics that were playing out across the city. How are these kind of actual people who were doing the building viewed? Additionally, you go into some detail about how actual stylistic eclecticism and the kind of combination of, Chinese styles with more European ones was kind of seen as both, in some ways appealing and in some ways interesting to foreign architects, but also somehow threatening. Could you say something about those kind of, racializing dynamics?
Yeah. So the stereotyping of the Chinese builder as a kind of inscrutable character, someone who lacked both the skills necessary to construct well-built architecture, but also lacked some of the ethics of building, the notion of carpenters as being duplicitous in a way and cunning and trying to cut corners, all of these emerge within these racially charged dynamics of the building industry in Shanghai at the turn of the century. And they become particularly charged by foreign architects who feel that their expertise is being challenged and threatened. And there's rivalries and tensions taking place within the Chinese building industry largely split along kind of local and non-local guilds that plays an additional role in this. And insofar as builders and craftsmen from Guangzhou were often more willing to work with foreign clients and foreign architects, in part because of the longer history of that city, or the longer history, I should say, of the foreign presence in that city. And so those carpenters were often in some ways seen as more reliable somehow. Over the course of at the turn of the century and over the course of the early 1900s, there's all of these different kind of this factionalism that begins to develop, plays out in interesting ways through the architecture itself, where you see, as you said, an increasingly kind of eclectic style emerging within Shanghai, where Chinese builders are appropriating quote unquote Western ornamental motifs and decoration. There's an effort on the part of several tea houses within Shanghai that cater to Chinese clients to kind of appropriate foreign fixtures and foreign elements to their architecture to kind of create an additional atmosphere of exoticism to appeal to a Chinese consuming class. But that also works on the other side of the equation, where you have foreign residents who are kind of appropriating Chinese aesthetics and kind of orientalizing themselves, as it were, with costume and with specific architectural motifs.
Yeah, and you kind of point out how this has a double-edged sword kind of quality to it, right, where it seemed to embody both I don't know, in this racially charged atmosphere, as you point out, a kind of pollution of certain pure European, I guess, aesthetics and ideals, but also, you know, at the same time, perhaps represents the aspirational kind of cosmopolitanism of a place which has this sort of diverse population and kind of unique, you know, cosmopolitan quality. But moving on, if there is, you know, a sort of Shanghai style which has emerged by, I guess, the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, this plays a kind of growing role, I think you highlight, as the Qing dynasty gives way to the Republican era in China. And so how did the kind of new political regime after 1911, 1912, the foundation of the Republic, kind of digest or make use of this architectural legacy and inheritance that was there in Shanghai?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. With the establishment of the Kuomintang and specifically the Republican government in Shanghai itself, all of these questions of legitimacy and territorial sovereignty, of course, remain as important vital considerations. And the Kuomintang government is very much engaged and interested in bringing Shanghai back within the fold of the Chinese nation, as it were. And architecture, I think, and broader urban planning strategies are all deployed to project or to suggest an element of Republican authority over a city that, in fact, was very much a kind of uncontrolled, sprawling, diverse, complex, again, this word, cosmopolitan environment. And so the use of architecture, specifically, I think, in the use of the Greater Shanghai Plan, which is an effort literally to kind of to move the physical center of Shanghai northward, to move it out of the foreign settlements and into tabula rasa, as it were. That becomes maybe the most notable example of that effort.
And in terms of how much of that plan, which I think you sort of point out was drawn up there in the early Republican period. I mean, how much was that successfully realized? I mean, you highlight kind of again simultaneously occurring infrastructural and transport developments, for example, the introduction of new roads and a tram system through the French concession and so on. What kind of spatial transformations were brought about by that particular plan, and what were kind of just ongoing, somewhat improvised and chaotic acts which unfolded because of the interaction of this kind of multiplicity of populations?
Well, the seeds of the plan lie in a project developed and published by Sun Yat-sen to develop Shanghai and to create essentially a new port for Shanghai that removes the commercial control of the city from the grips of the foreign powers and kind of re-empowers the Republican government. And so the plan is to move the municipal center of the city and to create a new port north along the river beyond the existing foreign settlements. And it's an incredibly ambitious undertaking that becomes very difficult and ultimately impossible to realize due to the kind of chronic misadministration of the city, and also just the lack of funds, and of course all of the uncertainties associated with Japanese invasion of China in the early 1930s, and the kind of encroaching Japanese army southwards down towards Shanghai. And so, as the plan is, it kind of slowly materializes, building by building. There's this this is undoubtedly hindsight, but there seems to be this kind of tragedy, this tragic ending inscribed within the architecture from its beginnings. It's such an ambitious plan that is so disconnected from the existing city that ultimately it becomes a kind of island unto itself and is goes unrealized, but then becomes the civic center of the occupying Japanese government during World War II.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in terms of, some spatial changes and kind of significant alterations did occur nevertheless, right? And it's at this point or this rough period when those city walls that we mentioned right at the beginning did kind of get torn down and removed as a symbol of separation, and perhaps in the Republican government's eyes, a symbol of a kind of older Qing order of things. At what point did they go, and what were the sort of debates around demolishing the walls and the reasons for their eventual destruction?
Yeah, that's actually an earlier moment. The city walls are torn down over a period of a year, 18 months, 2 years, in 1912. So with the fall of the Qing Empire then the establishment of the new Republic of China, there is an effort on the part of Chinese, the Chinese business community to open the city up. There's a belief that the city walls have unduly limited the commercial potential of the city. And there's also, of course, emerging discourses about public hygiene and the need for light and air to infuse urban environments for the betterment of the broader health of the public. And so the decision is made to tear down the city wall, which essentially connects the historical Chinese city with the French concession and the international settlement much more fluidly, and it's much easier than to travel between these various sections of the city. So that's a conversation and a debate happening, between 1912, 1913, and it radically changes the Chinese city's status relative to the other municipalities or the municipal governments within Shanghai. The Greater Shanghai Plan then emerges 15 years later in 1929, 1930, but it very much comes out of, I think, this conversation about the status and the position of the Chinese city and the Chinese municipality relative to the foreign settlements.
And I guess, finally sort of drawing on that impetus of openness and a new vision for China as a nation and with a place in the world, and kind of modernization as a sort of liberatory ideal, a liberationist idea, as you point out. What was then kind of the role envisioned for Shanghai on the kind of global stage as a laboratory for training, I guess, Chinese architects to represent the nation, and as also as a kind of showcase, I guess, for this newly competent China? How did that kind of play out as a new narrative for the city?
Well, in part because there were existing foreign practices already at work within Shanghai. The city became a magnet for young, talented Chinese architects who have been trained in Japan, Europe, the United States, who upon returning back to China then moved to Shanghai to work for some of these foreign firms. Some of them also then established their own practices within the city. Shanghai was one of the largest, most commercially active cities in China at the time. Of course, Guangzhou, Tianjin, these were also cities that appealed to Chinese architects. But something about, I think, the architectural culture of Shanghai and the opportunities available there were incredibly appealing to young Chinese designers. And given the kind of nationalist spirit that pervaded the place, it undoubtedly had an impact upon how Chinese architects conceived of their work relative to the struggles of the young Chinese nation state, and very much contributed to debates and discussions being had within the Chinese architectural community about what constituted a modern Chinese architecture, what constituted the modern Chinese architect. And you see organizations being established by these young architects, engineers, planners, all committed to professionalization, but also much more broadly to the kind of defense and the development of a strong Chinese nation.
And you, I guess, in the kind of final closing chapter, highlight some of the global spread of that new mission to international exhibitions and the kind of place that Shanghai and Shanghai architects then projected or had in the world as a projection of Chinese emerging status and so on. But anyway, Cole, that's a fantastic kind of conversation, I think, about the book, and I think it's one that contains many, many details that we were sadly not able to deal with in this discussion, but which I would heartily encourage listeners to go looking for by picking up the book itself. But having taken up a decent chunk of your time, before we let you go, I'd just like to ask what sort of our traditional final question, which is, what is it you've got on the go at the moment, following on from this project?
Yeah, a lot of these issues and questions involving sovereignty, extraterritoriality, the role of architecture, and its participation in these moments of political economic change, they also inform some of the work that I'm doing now. I've just completed a book that looks at architecture in China during the late Mao and post-Mao periods. So essentially trying to understand how architecture is contributing to the reform, the opening up and reform era. And there, during the 70s and then through the 80s, particularly after 1978, you begin to see architecture really, again, playing an active role in the transformation of Chinese society as the party begins to embrace more market-oriented economic policy, whether it's the construction of international hotels, the establishment, of course, of special economic zones, but also changes in how architects were practicing. In the 1980s, new discourses about postmodernism, all of these architectural elements I see as really crucial, if understudied, components to reform itself. So that's a book that I'm literally in the process of revising and wrapping up now, and I hope that will be out next year.
Fantastic.
And then I also have two projects that are not fully baked yet, but one of which looks at China's architectural history and engagement with the African continent after 1949. So taking what's happening today, where of course there's a lot of conversation about Chinese infrastructural projects in numerous countries around Africa, trying to understand the moment, the contemporary moment, as having a history and having a context that actually goes back to the late 1950s and early 1960s, where Mao and the party are beginning to court, if you will, newly decolonized African countries and young charismatic African leaders, and architecture becomes a tool in that process. So that's something that I'm just beginning to outline and understand now. And then in light of what's happening in Hong Kong and has happened over the last year, I'm at work on what will be, I hope, a book-length study of Hong Kong's built environment, a kind of critical architectural history of the city filtered through this lens of crisis and uncertainty.
Fantastic. Well, I think those all sound in their own ways incredibly valuable new examinations of, you know, real kind of pivotal junctures in recent Chinese history and indeed in contemporary China. So we'll look forward very much to getting our hands on all of them as and when they appear. But in the meantime, Cole, thank you very much for appearing on the show today. It's been really wonderful talking to you.
Thank you, Ed. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate all of your questions.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, too, for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.